Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin, and I am in conversation today with Rabbi Noah Farkas, who is the CEO of the Jewish Federation of Los Angeles. CEO, right? That's the full title, or is it CEO and president? I know there's it varies in the position.
President and CEO, technically.
Okay. Yes, yeah. Not sure even what that's supposed to mean, but here you are with us today to talk about your new role. And because I'm bad at reading bios off pages, I'm going to let you introduce yourself and how you found yourself in this really, you know, critical and amazing role.
Thanks, Michelle. Great to see you again, and thanks for having me on. So the very, very short version of the bio is that I've been a pulpit rabbi for 14 and a half years here in Los Angeles, in Encino at a wonderful congregation called Valley Beth Shalom. I was there right out of school. And before I went there, before I was a pulpit rabbi, I was a student in New York, but I was very involved with a number of things, including a synagogue in Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina. And when I was at VBS, I did a lot of work in innovation spaces, Jewish engagement, next generation engagement. I did a lot of work around spiritual enlightenment and also in social justice and government and community affairs. And after 14 years, like many of us, we just decided it's time for something different. And got a phone call one day from a friend who asked me to consider maybe moving to the Federation. And at the time, I didn't know exactly everything that the Federation does. And it's hard to imagine, even for your listeners, just how large a Federation can be and how much effect it has on Jewish life.
Right.
But then I was asked to come, and over the period of several weeks, interviewed, really thought deeply about it, went for long walks, and decided to make the jump. And now a year and a half later, here I am running one of the largest Jewish organizations in the country.
Wonderful. That is quite the unexpected journey, I'm sure, in terms of where you thought your pulpit would take you when you started your work at VBS. So I want to kind of start there because, you know, there's all different ways people can be rabbis in this world. And your particular way of, you know, being a rabbi was not just, you know, congregational work, and not that there's any, you know, value judgment to that. But I'm curious that, you know, from that history, as you were starting your rabbinate, what was it about what you were seeing, you know, but in the social justice realm, but in other sort of things within the Los Angeles community that made you sort of jump into all those other things that I assume that your synagogue work wasn't the reason that they wanted you to take on this role, but I also assume that it was your outward facing work that you did in all these other areas that sort of attracted you to them.
Yeah, I thank you for that. And to be really clear, every rabbinate is different because every rabbi is different, and
right,
the people they work with, whether they're Jews or even non-Jews, are different. So every path has its own value. I've always been an innovative, outwardly facing, sort of pushing for systemic change since before I went to rabbinical school. I knew I wanted to be a rabbi from the time I was 15. I grew up in a small town in Texas, conservative Jewish family, which meant we had three sets of dishes. We had milk dishes, meat dishes, and Chinese food dishes. And we experienced really a joyous Jewish life, but also there was just an awful amount of anti-Semitism. It was both physical and emotional. And already being a bit of a disaffected kid, parents helped get me to Israel for the first time. And ironically, through the help of the Federation, local Federation there. I went to Israel, and it was really the first time where my insides felt like my outsides and my outsides felt like my insides. And I felt really called in that moment too, Michelle. It wasn't just about feeling normal. I felt a vocation would be probably the best word. And it called me to the to our people, that called me to our tradition and to the rabbinate. And I spent my whole life since 15 on that journey. And it's brought me all over the world, from the developing world in Africa to the Ukraine, to El Salvador, to New York, to Mississippi, to California, to Berlin, to just all over the world. So that my first calling was always to Jewish life and the Jewish people. And then I found my second calling right before rabbinical school. As I said before, I was living in West Africa volunteering, and it was the first time I saw abject poverty and real suffering. It was the first time that I understood privilege, and it was the first time that I saw the yawning chasm that is the difference between the way the world is and I think what our tradition expects the way the world should be. And I had that experience so profound. I met this little girl the last night I was there, and she was dying of dysentery. And she looked me in the eyes, and it didn't matter what I was volunteering for. I felt so enervated, like all the power went out. And the next morning I was, that night, but then by the 2 days later, I was already back in Texas. And 2 weeks after that, I started rabbinical school. And the power of how it was the same level of power that I felt when I was 15, calling me to tradition and authentic Jewish living, that I felt called to social justice that night in Africa. And that became my second great vocation. So I have really had those two at the heart, sort of my like two tablets from the very beginning of my rabbinate. And so through rabbinical school, I've always balanced those two. How much Jewish learning, how much Talmud, how much Jewish philosophy, all areas I care very deeply about, have cared very deeply about. And how much do we apply that theology to the world in which we live to make each person's life better, to make the Jewish community stronger, more well-protected and more joyous, and ultimately to make the world stronger. And that's just been who I am. And I see myself more as a servant of that or a vessel for that than the work I do myself. It's not for me, it's for the world. And so that brought me into all sorts of interesting spaces over the course of the last decade and a half, including doing international work, but also here in LA, really focusing on homelessness and seeing the people who are just living in abject poverty. I mean, just yesterday, the commission I used to be a part of issued its annual report. And here in LA County, there's 71,500 people experiencing homelessness. I mean, just think about that. There are cities in America that aren't that big.
Right.
So this is a real scourge and an embarrassment and a stain on the city, but also on all of us in the country that we have in the same, you know, 10-mile square radius, some of the largest estates and fancy mansions in the world, and yet there's 72,000 people who won't have a place to sleep tonight.
Right. Okay. Well, that's what that's one way to start off a conversation.
You just line me up. I start going.
Absolutely. I mean, I asked, but you know, it's you know, in addition to the chills that I have listening to your experiences, I mean, just the beauty of that experience of, you know, a lost life in that situation, sparking something in you that I'm sure has made a really big impact throughout your time. So I want to just kind of, in sort of our intro space, tell me a little bit about the Los Angeles Jewish Federation, what it does, what it focuses on, and just kind of the sort of overarching, what is this particular federation?
Yeah, there's an old adage, if you know one federation, you know one federation. Every federation is very different. You think about a tzedakah box for a minute. So for those of you who don't know, a tzedakah box is like, it's a little vessel, a canister that we put in philanthropy, charity. And it's considered as one of the holy objects that a Jew should have in their life. So, whoop, there goes my... Sorry. Similar to a kiddush cup, similar to a set of candlesticks, the tzedakah box is what's called a clay kodesh, a holy vessel, because philanthropy, tzedakah, we call in Hebrew, is a mitzvah. It's something that we should do. And in every city and in every country in the world, there has always been a community pot of money, a community chest that is collected, tzedakah box of tzedakah boxes, collects philanthropy, collects charity, and then tries to give it out to the Jewish community and to the larger community in which they live in order to make people's lives better. And at its core, that's what the Federation is and has always been, is that in America, the system for that is through the 501c3 nonprofit, and that system is what we call the Federation.
Okay.
Our Federation, so at its core, is we take philanthropy and we transform it into a safe, secure, engaged, dynamic Jewish life here in Los Angeles, in Israel, and across 70 different countries across the world. And the federations, there are 146 federations in the United States and Canada. And we raise annually about $3 billion in post-tax philanthropy, making it one of the largest private philanthropic networks in the world, which represents the value of charity in the Jewish community, supporting Jews and supporting the poor, supporting those in need across the globe. Our Federation, living here in Los Angeles, has a particular niche that's unique to us. We don't just support agencies. We partner with them to create initiatives. We don't give unrestricted or general gifts. We give restricted gifts, but they're really targeted strategic partnerships to move forward on our data-driven strategies to change the systems that are here in LA to support those who need or in need. So last year, I just told you how many homeless people there are in LA County. Last year, the Federation helped prevent, through food assistance, housing assistance, and other types of assistance, 61,000 Jews here in LA from falling into homelessness. So that number could be, you know, that number of who is homeless could be catastrophically larger if it weren't for organizations like ours.
Right.
And we do that through a series of programs and initiatives. We also send thousands of people, of kids, to Jewish schooling, Jewish program, as we build Jewish joy and Jewish identity. We send about 5,000 people to Israel every year through scholarship programs. So it's really great when I get to help fund the next teenager, just as I was funded by Federation, to be able to fund the next teenager who maybe will become a Jewish leader. Because we're able to get them to be connected to their homeland. And we do a lot of leadership development here in LA. We have 5 leadership development programs trying to improve both the Jewish Civic Society board members, et cetera, but also we train young civically minded Jews to run for office and to bring the Jewish voice into civic spaces. That's a really particular crown jewel and niche of what we do. And lastly, because of the world that we live in today, we have shifted in the last year to start joining the efforts of fighting anti-Semitism explicitly. And we created a comprehensive strategy around that back in November and are executing on that strategy. And really, the real value proposition of federations is our power to convene the Jewish community and also civic partners. So we established an anti-Semitism roundtable that has CEOs of every organization in town or directors of organizations in town that work on anti-Semitism. We're building new partnerships with the Anti-Defamation League, with the AJC, with the local Museum of the Holocaust, with the Board of Rabbis and others to coordinate our efforts to fight anti-Semitism together. And the Federation, we don't own the table. It's not our place to say it's our strategy, but we convene. We physically own the physical table.
Yes.
but our power to convene is really important. And lastly, just on the anti-Semitism piece, as you know, it's been in the news a lot here, massive number of upticks and incidences and crimes. But we also believe the best way to fight anti-Semitism is to create Jewish joy and Jewish pride. So we spend a lot of efforts in showing the joy of Judaism, Jewish life. It was a national billboard campaign that went up with some Jewish wisdom around LA. Now it's going to other cities. But the idea is the joy of Judaism gives us our greatest weapon against hate.
Right. So what I'm hearing is you've inherited as you came into this role that, not to say you didn't want, but like you didn't seek out, right? You weren't like, oh, the CEO position's open. Let me get for it. And it's a cruise liner, right? It is just a giant organization with how many employees do you have?
Yeah, so our annual budget is just north of $50 million a year, mm-hmm. and we have 146, I think, employees. That fluctuates based on grant cycles, we cover about 4,000 square miles of territory.
Oh, in terms of the area that you serve in Los Angeles.
Our catchment.
Yeah. So I'd love to just hear a couple of questions I'll kind of throw at you. So the first thing is, what were your expectations coming into this role and how has that changed, a year and a half in? But also what is your leadership philosophy? Because there's just a million things being tossed at you. And I can only assume and hope that there are, people under you that you trust in terms of, them doing their job well. So you don't have to pay so much attention to various things, but you've got 146 employees. You've got a whole lot of donors, right? You've got the actual partners. You've got a physical building that I'm sure has its own stuff, right, to manage. And constant competing priorities that are just kind of pulling you in lots of different directions. And so, obviously expectations. And then also, we'll talk a little bit more about going into the future. But sitting in that sort of captain seat with all these various things, I think one of the things for CEOs in general is that balance. And so I think some CEOs are really good at staff engagement and management and development, and some are really great with lay leaders and boards and, resource development, and some people are really great executors, right? Everyone's kind of got their thing, but this role in any organization, let alone the one your size, really requires some strategic leadership direction of saying, this is how I show up in managing all these different priorities and areas to ensure this organization it continues to be successful.
Yeah, it's a great question. So we have over 10,000 donors. We have hundreds of thousands of square feet of office space. We have 175 partners across the world that we work with. So it is a sprawling organization, as I said, 146 employees. But here's when I try to figure out, and it's going to evolve because we are, right, all of us evolve all the time, try to figure out strategic priorities. For me, the number one thing to realize is that the power of federation, the power of this organization, really is the marriage between the lay leadership and the working staff. Mm-hmm. And that no one person, no one donor, no one staff member can run the whole organization or shape the whole organization and its image, because we're just too big for that. So the organization itself becomes an identity. And to me, the way an organization like this should run, and not saying we're the best at it, but it's something I aspire to, is to give our employees the freedom and creativity and the space to know and the expertise and the training to know and to execute on the strategy for the organization and ultimately for the community itself. Mm-hmm. It cannot be run. I have to be, as a CEO, I have to be the person who is not the bottleneck.
Right.
Actually make less decisions. The decisions need to be pushed down into the executive staff and by extension into the senior vice president level and the operators. And that they have to be given strategic direction and feedback and all of those things. But you cannot micromanage an organization like this. You have to allow the best people to be there at their best. And we hire the best. We have experts in education. We have experts in security and anti-Semitism. We have experts on Israel. We have experts on social services, human services. We have experts up and down the ladder. And across all the horizontals, the goal is to hire the best and get out of their way. And my job is to do that on the staffing side.
Yeah. And I was going to say that's, I think a Steve Jobs quote that's like, you hire smart people, not for you to tell them what to do, but for them to tell you what to do and what needs to happen.
That's, I think he's right about that.
Yeah.
He's right about that. I think that's exactly right. Like, we hire the best and allow them to innovate, come with ideas. I mean, the CEO shouldn't be the most innovative person in every conversation. Mm. There might be some big ideas, big strategic directions, but the most innovative people are the people who allow the ideas to percolate and come up and then tell us, tell me, tell the executive staff what they're hearing on the ground and how to best react to that.
Right.
And that's what I try to emulate. I do want to say that I do think it's the CEO's place to create culture and to create a clarity around values so that employees know what's expected of them, not just in terms of their outcomes and outputs of their work, but how they show up to work. What are the values of the institution, of the organization? And what commitments are they willing to make around trust and positivity and a bias for clarity, transparency, action, kavod, honor, and respecting each other? I think the CEO is responsible for that.
Yeah, I'm actually doing, I don't know if you know the book, now I can't even think of it. I'm using it for Great Mondays. That's what it is. I'm using it for my staff retreat because that's, you know, given the pandemic, I've been in my role, I'm on my fifth year and, you know, pandemic kind of took a big chunk out of that. But coming to the realization exactly that, I'm like, we need to sit around the table. And luckily there's only 12 of us that are full-time, you know, office staff and talk about what is not the purpose of our organization, but what is the purpose of our staff here together? What are our values? What are behaviors we want to promote? And what are behaviors we don't want to do anymore? And having that clarity, I think, you know, before you go into a programmatic year, which a synagogue just happens to have in that way, you know, without those, it's everyone has their own value system that they think is how it should be. Like, do you have a stated like Jewish Federation values are these as an employee, or is it just the culture that you've created there?
I wouldn't say I fully created the culture because I'm only a year and a half in, and I hope to have that document. It's something we're working on. Mm-hmm. It's something we want to align all of ourselves, including our board, by the way.
Right.
I think it's important that the board also, if you're working in the nonprofit space, the board needs to be able to articulate those values. They need to be part of that strategic planning process around those values too, because they have, in many ways, we're responsible to them. So if they all understand it, we can point to it and say, this is what we believe in. And the truth is, I do plan, because we're so large, I do plan on creating those big posters and putting them up right in conference rooms and all of that, because people should be reminded. We have a sprawling infrastructure. We own multiple buildings we own. We have offices in Israel. So it's just a matter of that everyone understands those, and we should do training around them and highlight and reward employees, and I don't just mean financially, but reward employees in 100 other ways as well around those values. And I think that's really important. And when it comes to the other work, I really see that the, at least as a Federation CEO, you take responsibility for the entire Jewish community as a spokesperson, not because it's positional power. You have to earn that. I have to earn that power. So I spend a lot of time driving around the city, meeting with Jewish leaders, getting them, hearing from them, listening for them, trying to find ways of connecting them to supporters. Mm-hmm. In many ways, I think I try to cast the Federation of LA anyway as being the least self-interested Jewish organization, because all of our constituencies are everyone who cares about the Jewish community, whether you're Jewish or not.
Right.
And I mean, I've been known to turn donors over to other organizations who I think are a better fit than just finding through. Yeah, because it's just about the mission. If the community does well, the Federation does well. And if the Federation does well, the community does well.
Right.
And not every donor is a Federation donor. Although I think every Jew who cares about the Jewish community should consider giving a gift to Federation as a way of sort of baseline giving tzedakah to the Jewish community. And I'd love to get back to that. That's a heavy lift with 750,000 Jews living here in LA.
Yeah, but, happy to get back to that.
The idea that everyone should make a small contribution to the entire community and then pick the areas that they really want to focus on themselves, mm-hmm. either with us in partnership with us or on your own. I really feel strongly about that. So I really believe that the head of the Federation is a servant leader, and you're not just in service to your own staff. I'm not just in service to my own staff or to my own board. I'm in service to the Jewish community.
So I want to go back to the question that I asked initially about expectations. So, mm-hmm. you know, you're presented with being asked to do this. You talk with your family about it. You know, weigh the pros and cons. You talk to your staff at VBS and you say, okay, let's do this. You know, there's, you know, the expectations that you kind of walked in the door with. And now, you know, sort of looking a year and a half later at, you know, not necessarily the reality of the job, but, you know, you're in it now, right? And so I'm just curious, you know, what you might have assumed when you came in and what the reality is and how those expectations lined up.
It's hard to say what exactly the expectations were. We build up all this expectations and with a lack of information. Our brains just do that naturally. And I always thought, oh, the Federation's this big black box bank that doesn't do, you know, that only picks winners and losers and nobody really knows what they do. It's just a small group of donors who can overly control the Jewish community, you know?
Right.
And the truth is, maybe it was that at one point. I have no idea. That was just my assumption. Like walking, you see a big building on Wilshire Boulevard and you see the logo and, you know, the wealthiest Jews are involved. So therefore, that's what it is. And then it has unending money or what have you. And like every other organization, it's not at all what you see from the outside. Mm-hmm. The Federation really does partner with its donors, but it partners with hundreds of thousands of people to try to figure out what's best for the Jewish community. It's not just our ideas. We just finished a major strategic planning process that included hundreds of interviews and panels and things to learn. And then we're going to, you know, and by the end of this year, by Rosh Hashanah, we're going to reveal what we've learned and what we're going to work on, because this is what we see that the Jewish community needs. Mm. And so what I've learned in this process, and we triggered that process last October, so I was already here when we started. But what I learned from that is that there is nobody who doesn't take breath by breath, step by step at the Jewish Federation that doesn't think about the Jewish community, helping the Jewish community every single day.
Right.
And we all wished more people knew about the work that we did. And we all wish we had more money to give away.
Right.
Well, because that's our pride. That's the core. So what some other things that I came in that I didn't know about, I didn't know that we ran an office in Israel that lifts Israelis out of poverty and does. I didn't know that we do innovative work bringing Israeli Palestinians and Israeli Jews together and to do social cohesion. I didn't know that. Right. I didn't know the extent and to how many people we help financially every year. I was just delighted and surprised by the number of our ability to quickly mobilize in the face of the Ukraine war, $5.6 million to put to work to moving 40,000 Jewish refugees out of harm's way, bringing some of those to Israel, doing workforce development there so they're absorbed in Israel. We were able to, this was just something that just really blew my mind. We support the only Russian speaking and now Ukrainian speaking Jewish full-time summer camp in the country. It's the last 2 weeks of the summer and at the war last year, and we'll probably do it again this year. We flew in kids who are refugees from all over the country here to California where they had 2 weeks of summer camp, and we hired mental health professionals who speak Russian and Ukrainian, and we help these kids through deep levels of trauma.
Yeah.
Wow. There's one kid who showed up at camp and crawled. He wouldn't sleep in his bunk. He would only sleep under his bunk.
Mm.
And he wouldn't leave the cabin for the first 4 days. So they had brought him meals in the cabin, and the psychologist worked with him. And by the end of the 2 weeks, he was outside playing with the other kids, laughing and having a good time and exploring his Jewish identity. And that kind of reparative work, like, that's just another Thursday for us.
Right.
And I wish more people knew that the power that Federation has to transform lives, all of them.
Well, and that's what you kind of were alluding to before I went back to this question, right? You were you still are a prominent rabbi, but you were, you know, a prominent rabbi at a very large conservative congregation in Los Angeles doing all this outward facing work, and you didn't know what the Federation did, right? So for you, you're now sitting in the seat being like, how do we get people to give to the Federation? How do we get people to, and my husband worked for our local Federation that I absolutely adore. And when he was working there, he was having a conversation with the CEO and he's like, how do we get people to drink the Kool-Aid, right? The Federation Kool-Aid, to understand, because the sort of general giving to seemingly anonymous pots, right, is just not really part of our ethos anymore, right? It was a really strong part of our ethos many, many, many years ago and generations ago of, you know, kind of that tithing sense and just your obligation to, you know, the Jewish community. And, you know, it's that perception problem that I'm sure your strategic plan is working on, you know, that you mentioned that, you know, somebody even in your position previous didn't really understand what was going on at the Federation. So how could you expect anybody in your congregation to really understand what was going on in the Federation? And seems like, you know, whether the strategic plan or not, but that's, you know, that focus and, you know, our conversation right now and sharing some of these things and really, like, how do you, and I think a lot of nonprofits struggle with that. I mean, we struggle with that as a synagogue in terms of we don't have any way to right now really share out the stuff that happens here. So we have the calendar of stuff and then the stuff happens and everyone enjoys it and has a good time. But if you, you know, don't belong to XYZ group and you only know what goes on with the things that you engage with. And so it's a struggle for us as well of how do we share out in a meaningful way for people to actually understand what's happening within these walls that is making us so successful that people are really connecting to.
Yeah, totally. And I think this day and age just makes it three times harder because everyone is in information overload.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The God bless the internet. It's why we can do this conversation today. Right. But how many emails do you get? How many texts do you get? How much is on your Facebook, your Instagram, your Snapchat, your TikTok, whatever it is, right? Twitter. Like, it becomes a sea of information. And so the only way to navigate that, which I'm not saying we're great at, it's something I'm trying to invest in next year, is just you have to find the right people and the right networks and inspire them and then lean on them to help inspire others.
Mm.
And that's very, influencers have figured out how to monetize this, but I'm less interested in that. I think that's too transactional a way of approaching this. This has to be done organically. And there are ways to do it. It's retail. It's not wholesale. We have to go very slow. One transaction, one relationship at a time. That will address some of the marketing pieces, I believe.
Right.
To be more strategic about where you put your resources. I am very excited, and I can't share all of it, of where we're going with our Federation's annual campaign.
Mm.
It will be the opposite of a black box. We're calling it focused giving. And the idea is we have six strategies, many of the ones I articulated to you. And rather than giving to a black box, you'll be able, Michelle, to spend your precious earned hard-earned money in tzedakah on any one or all of those six strategies. Mm. And you can click and say, I want to fight anti-Semitism. I want to give money to Israel. I don't want to give money to Israel. I want to give money to people who are suffering who need food. I want to give it to wherever the Federation thinks it's most important in this moment, right? Mm-hmm. We'll have all of these different options. We call it focus giving. You're not going to choose the organization.
Right.
And most people don't have the time to go through and look through the popularity contest that is all of these organizations begging for attention. We have the time. We have the leadership. We have the expertise. We create the strategies around that, and we will choose the organizations to invest in based on the pools of money that the community has told us is their priority. And the idea is to bring the community closer to our work and to bring our work closer to the community. So we're trying to, we're going to be eliminating the black box idea, and we, so that you can focus your giving on an area that you are most passionate, but you'll trust us to invest those dollars in the most impactful way possible.
Right. And then the challenge, I'm sure, for you is that, you know, if one of those buckets is Israel, right, that's also a big bucket of what you guys do. And sort of how do you then draw out that story of the Ukrainian refugee and how you impacted that person's life, that even somebody looking at those six options says, I know what it means when I put my money in this bucket, that it's going to translate to what, 61,000 Jews that, you know, were kept out of homelessness. And, you know, like you said, you have a wonderful team to, you know, help work on that. But that's always a challenge, right? You've got these really amazing little stories and these little, you know, things that people connect with, that, you know, that's a challenge of getting that out there. So you kind of started with it, but I'll lead us a little more. Anything else? You know, you have the strategic plan that you're working on, you know, trying to give a little more transparency around the giving. Anything else that you're like, the future is this for us?
Yeah.
Or even for you.
I mean, I have dozens of these in my head, but I'll give you one more. We are the most diverse and dispersed Jewish community in the United States. Mm-hmm. We are, you know, our catchment area, as I said, is about 4,000 square miles. The state of Israel is 9,000 square miles. So just so you understand how big we are, we're massive. And we have the least Ashkenazi, least white Jewish community in the United States. And so we have to change the way we approach our community and really understand that we have to put diversity at the center of what we do, because our community is so much more diverse. That means not just who we fund and the kinds of programs that we fund, but the kind of language that we use, who sits on the committees to make those decisions, who sits in our leadership, what does our staff look like? All of those have to be revolutionized in the next few years, because we really want to mirror the community. We have the largest and most amazing Persian, Iranian American Jewish community in the United States. New York is a close second. We need to partner more and figure out, what does Nowruz look like for the Jewish community? And should we be sending emails in Farsi as well as in English? We have one of the largest Israeli American elements of the Jewish community here in Los Angeles. So what does Israel Independence Day look like?
Right.
What does Yom HaZikaron look like? And should we be sending emails, tweets, et cetera, in Hebrew as much as we're sending them in English? We have one of the largest Russian and Ukrainian speaking diasporas in the Jewish community here in Los Angeles. Should we be sending those things in Russian? Should we be celebrating May Day? Should we? Right, I can go on and on and on. These are the kinds of things that we're talking about. It's that it's not just get them to get all of these other groups to be more Ashkenazi, more American, more Southern Californian. How do we get the Federation to look like them? So that's the diversity piece.
Love that.
And then on the dispersion piece, I mean, it is a moral problem, the geographic dispersion of our El Angelino community. Mm-hmm. We have families that refuse to get together on Friday night for Shabbat dinner because they just don't want to fight an hour and 15 minutes in traffic to get from one side of the city to the other.
Yeah. There are reasons I live in New Jersey now. Not saying that it's all that.
How
but
do we expect to run this? We have to think about what does the Federation look like on a neighborhood level?
Yeah.
What does it look like? What can the Federation do with, for, and on your behalf in your neighborhood, in a 5-mile square radius from where you live? Mm-hmm. So the future is community hubs. And those hubs could be, and I'm just going to give you, think of a bunch of different visions with me for a minute. There are 100 different ways of doing this. They could be a new physical infrastructure that has an early childhood center. It could have a workforce development platform with a vocational service. It could have home health care workers based there. It could be a senior center. It could be a place where there are social workers and case managers. It could not be a physical infrastructure. It could be four or five Federation staff co-located at a synagogue that are doing vocational services, family services. It could be doing mental health work. It could be co-located at a school. The schools are used a certain number of hours a day for the most part. What about those off hours? Could there be young adult programming happening at a place that trains high school students? Could there be evening basketball in that gym? Could there be, and I could just keep going on and on and on. Federation needs to show up in places and not in, in cooperation with synagogues, in cooperation with schools, in cooperation with agencies to reach the Jews who are not yet being serviced or not yet being partnered with in the Jewish community. Our philosophy is that it is a gift to be a Jew because there's always a Jewish professional who's thinking about you, whether you know it or not. Mm. And we want those Jews out there to feel that they're never alone on their Jewish journey, whether you're a basketball Jew, a bagel Jew, a tzaddik Jew, a hummus Jew, a davening Jew, a studying Jew, a Zionist Jew, a tikkun olamist Jew, that there's always a Jewish professional who's thinking about you and would love to take you for coffee. Let's figure out how to marry the two together. And that is our job as the convener of the community. And not in the foreground, but in the background.
Right, right. So let's kind of zoom out to a much larger kind of view for a minute. You know, you came from a very hyper-local, obviously, a synagogue structure. And now you're, you know, in addition to a very large, you know, organization you lead, you're a part of a much larger national, albeit international, network of federations now. And I don't know how much over this last few, you know, year and a half that you've actually, or even just in your generally in your career, explored more of the general Jewish nonprofit landscape that's out there. But generally, you know, what's happening, in case you don't know, right? You know, umbrella synagogue organizations are not necessarily thriving, but you know, startup and incubated and, you know, various Jewish Your Way and One Table. And just, I mean, obviously the list is very, very, very long of Jewish organizations that have come to be, I'll even say in the last 20 or so years, that Judaism looks very different than it did 100 years ago in terms of how individual people engage Jewishly. So I'm curious from your, you know, 1,000-foot perspective, you know, A, what's working, what's not working, what's needed, what's missing, just about the sort of general Jewish landscape, you know, in the country for whatever you have to say on that topic in general.
Yeah, that's like a 2-hour conversation.
Right.
I'll boil it down to two ideas for us just for this, just to take a bite. Those organizations that can capture the Jewish imagination will thrive, and those that cannot capture the Jewish imagination will falter. Mm. And for 100 years or more, the movemental organizations, whether the Reform or Conservative, Reconstructionists, even the Orthodox, captured the imagination because we wanted to be part of something, the purpose of which is we wanted to be this thing, but which is not this other thing. And we had a theology, we have a way of doing it, we created universities, we created synagogues, we created youth movements, we created camping around it. It was all associated with that. And then sometime in the 90s, as identity began to change, those ideas stopped capturing our imagination. Because we stopped seeing, I'm not judgmental about this at all, but we stopped seeing ourselves first as part of something larger. Mm. And we started to see those things as the background material for which I create my life.
Right.
So that leads to the second idea, is the rise of the individual, the sovereign self, and that our work, our hobbies, our religion, our aspirations, our dreams are base material from which we create our life. we are not, we might be a part of those for as long as we feel that those are meaningful to us. But when they're no longer meaningful to us, we will find something else.
Right.
So the so that's the second idea, is the rise of the individual. If you don't capture someone's imagination, you won't be successful. That's number one. And people will, if they will build what they love, and they will love what they build, but they are at the center of this conversation. Mm. So you have, we, all of us, have to shift our thinking from inducing individuals to become the way we want them to become to, we are organizations that help propel them forward in their Jewish journey, their Jewish organizational, their Jewish identity.
Right.
And so federations are very well positioned for this. If we can work out the fundraising piece, that's why we're changing some of the fundraising. But you have to go from being a program to being a platform, a right. platform for our individual's life. So federations are very well positioned, because we are a platform for Jewish experimentation and to dealing with what's happening, addressing needs in the community. So a program we're running now might not exist in 3 years from now, because it's right. not effective. When would this change? Synagogues have it much harder. Schools have it much harder, because synagogues were founded as collectives of individuals who agreed to make life together around some central core tenets. And you're trying to recruit people to that.
Right.
And you're trying to, and you can be as welcoming as you want. You can create a whole spirituality of welcoming, but ultimately if they don't want to be the thing that you are, then they won't join. Right. Mm-hmm. And we create these barriers of entry, these memberships, right? So I don't know, Michelle, how big is your shul?
About 560 yeah. families.
Okay. So you have 560 families, which represents taking
2,000 or so people. Yeah.
Right. Every one of those people is a donor to your organization.
Mm-hmm.
That's your collective. The question is, how are you meaningful to them every single day? Every single one of those 2,000 people. And for us, you know, we have 10,000 donors, but we feel we're responsible for 650,000 people. Right. So, the question will always be for organizations like synagogues, how do you shift from program to platform? And maybe that means multiple places to pray, multiple minyanim. Maybe that means that you bring programs outside of the synagogue. One of the things I tried doing at VBS at one point was we geolocated every member family. And then we would find clusters of families and just say, we're here to support you, but did you know you live walking distance from five other families?
Oh, fun.
And just try to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. The answer for me so far has been free food. I'm like, if I just put out dinner and say, everyone who lives in West Orange, come and have dinner with each other. Everyone who lives in this area, everyone who has kids of this age. I mean, to me, it's, you know, it's been the best platform for, you know, you don't have to pay your $18 for it. You don't have to bring some potlucked item, right? Come eat schmooze, you know, and be. Right. And I see that, I mean, right there. There is, I was going to say, there is some that are platformy, like, you know, one table, and there are some that are more programmy, like the, you know, young adult camping experiences and weekend retreats and things like that. And so I'm seeing a variety of those different, you know, things being successful, but it definitely, in terms of that individual of saying, like, they have a million choices, and there's, even in Jewish life, there's just a million ways people could engage based on their own experience. And, you know, if there isn't relevancy, and to me, leadership from these, you know, umbrella organizations that influences that relevancy and that message. And that's what you're here for, right? Like, you're this, you know, CEO with this message of, you know, being relevant to people's lives, connecting them to this larger whole, like, give to the people you want to give to, but understand what it means to give to the Los Angeles Jewish community here. And it's, you know, I talk to CEOs of Jewish organizations for this exact reason, because, you know, these are the people that are really setting that stage for engaging Jewish life on so many different levels.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I'm just going back to your congregants. Every one of them made a decision to join the congregation, right?
Right.
And maybe they needed it for school or what have you, but But think about what they need you for. And then you, what's called value stacking. So you find the things that they need you for, and you put more resources into the things that they need you for. And the things they don't need you for, you put less resources into that. So that's how you amplify what's good, and you can get rid of what's not so good. And maybe they don't need you for Shabbat as much as you think that they do. So maybe your resources should be in hiring more youth directors and more social service people and less clergy, right? Yeah. Or something like that. I'm, and then of course, I'm just
yeah, well, we hired a consultant here. And he was saying, you know, if I were to design synagogues, you know, 100 years ago, I would have put the executive director as the leader of the organization and the rabbi as a content creator and spiritual leader that reports the executive director. And, you know, not saying anything against rabbis or structures, but in sort of thinking about that, you know, that particular way that synagogues, you know, operate was very interesting. Right. So I want to kind of pull away.
What that also would do is it would allow the rabbi to be the rabbi.
Right.
And not have to raise the funds and not have to manage the board and allow the rabbi to do what the rabbi's good at.
Yeah.
And what the rabbi's praying for and what we should expect from rabbis. And give the rabbi the freedom to express themselves appropriately, as all rabbis should be able to do.
Right. I mean, that was his argument. He was like, it would have saved a lot of my friends a lot of heartache and trouble and drama if that wasn't the expectation of rabbis in our community to be the ability to run an organization, which is not what they're, you know, trained to do or their skill set necessarily. But I digress from that. I wanted to, as we're getting closer to our time, talk a little bit about our audience. So our audience are Jewish professionals in who knows what variety. They're anonymous to me, but they like what I do. So that's good enough. So, you know, in a couple of ways, I had wanted to ask initially when you were talking about your staff and, you know, I love the value stuff that you were talking about and setting the stage. How are you present for your staff? Do you hold like a monthly everyone gathered together so I can talk to you? Do you walk around the office? Do you send an email notification? Like, how do you stay connected to these 146 people that work for you? Or do you not? I mean, that's okay too.
Yeah. I would say that I'm not great at it. And it's not because I don't want to be. It's just, right. It's a learning edge for me. We have monthly staff meetings and we try to celebrate staff. We try to do some fun things. Like we did a thing for both Juneteenth and Pride at the last one. And we like to give them food.
Always.
And one of the things I'm trying to do, it's not always easy given my schedule, I try to walk one or two of the floors every day. We have a 12-story building. So I try to, when I was in the Navy, it was called Ministry of Presence. And the idea is, just walking the cubicles, right. Walking the floors, and just checking in and laughing with people and seeing how they're doing and all that. And so with that many staff, it's way more difficult than you think it is. When I was at the synagogue, I could do it every day or two. And right. I'm lucky that I can get to one or two floors a week. And that's mostly because I'm not in the building a lot. I'm driving around. I mean, like, the CEO of a federation is the outwardly facing hunter in many ways. Like, I'm out there looking for the next foundation to partner with. I'm out there making a relationship with the elected official. I'm out there connecting with heads of schools. And so I try. It's one of those things where I feel like I could do much better at, and I would encourage those to do more. We do celebrate, you know, I've been celebrating staff monthly anniversaries, which is important. And trying to raise up the staff. I do care about the staff, obviously, and the staff culture. And we have other things that we do that the staff can do for themselves. Like we built a cafe and they, you know, have free food and coffee, stuff like that. But in terms of my personal interaction, it's like I can never do enough, and it never feels like enough. And I don't feel particularly successful at it, although I wish it was more. And so if you or any of the other CEOs out there have suggestions of how to do it quickly, because it's always hard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, that's necessarily the answer, right? You're also in a leadership position in which you articulated to me in this particular conversation that I trust my staff. We hire the best. You just communicated that these 146, and maybe not all of them, and you're working on it, but you know that we hire particularly for a reason, and there's an element of trust and not needing to micromanage. And although, you know, everybody wants a piece of your time, working for an organization for which there is a leader and a CEO at the top that says, I trust you. And I'm going to promote that to my lay leadership, who are your partners. I'm going to make sure that they know that. I'm going to support you and have your back, even if I've seen you only at staff meetings, right? Even though I've only seen you once a month, and maybe I don't, maybe your name is Karen, maybe it's not Karen, but you know, the idea that like the person sitting at the top has the staff's back. And that it's not, you know, well, our lay leadership are the donors, or they're more important, or they're more, you know, attached and just do what they want because, you know, they know better for whatever reason. I mean, there's a lot of toxicity we can talk about in nonprofits, but regardless of your actual physical presence, I mean, that, you know, whether stated or unstated or trickled down from the top, I mean, I'm sure makes a really big difference about the way that your staff feels about working at the organization.
Totally. I will say, just because you picked up on it, is everything has a season. There are going to be times where the CEO really needs to partner with lay leadership more than the staff. And there are going to be times where the CEO needs to partner with staff more than the lay leadership.
Right.
And I can't tell you when that is, or, you know, a schedule for that. But if we're going through some deep strategic planning processes like we've been, that's the job of the staff to support the lay leadership who is doing the strategic planning. It is not the staff's job to do strategic planning. That's maybe if you're an executive, but the truth is it is the board of an agency anyway that sets the strategy and policies of the nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And so I have spent a great deal of time, maybe too much, I don't know, but a great deal of time with the lay leadership through this process, because they need to be managed and coached and led and supported as much as the staff does. So there are seasons, and seasons aren't a month or a week. They could be a year in which.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to end up with a document that the lay leadership's not going to execute, right? Your staff are going to have to execute on that. Right. And, you know, that tide might shift in terms of the support that you offer to them in actually seeing through that vision.
It is an incredible balance. It is an incredible balance, I will say.
Yeah, definitely. So any advice for, you know, people in the field, for people in all stages of their career, people looking to be CEOs, people saying, hell no, I don't want to be a CEO. Like, no, thank you, not for me. But as you said, you know, for all the Jews out there, there's a Jewish professional that's thinking about them and, you know, and their needs and connecting them to something larger than themselves. Any particular advice that you have? I mean, normally, if we had more time, would ask about how you keep your own life balanced. But, you know, really just kind of thinking about people listening, you know, about any words of wisdom that you might have for those in the field.
Yeah, I'll give just a couple because I know we're running out of time. Number one is, if you want to be a CEO, you have to understand staff management, strategy, project management. It's not good enough to just be a great speaker. Okay? And number two, you are going to take, as I have, and I think other CEOs know, if you're in the nonprofit space, Jewish nonprofit space anyway, you're going to take a lot of punishment. And that punishment is mostly unwarranted. And you have to know how to have a very high EQ so that you don't take it personally. You have to rise above it. You have to let yourself pass through it. So if you haven't had a coach on that or what have you, I strongly suggest that you would consider that. Third is, there is no difference between you and the organization. When I was in the Navy, the captain of the ship took the name of the ship and every ship I was on. So when you're on it, when they go over the PA and they say the captain is coming on board, they actually say the name of the ship, because there's no difference between the captain and the ship. The captain and the ship are synergistic. They're synonymous. They're interdependent. So if you become a CEO, that's what you should expect. But on the other side, the CEO, as much as it sounds like a rough go, also has the incredible privilege of inspiring staff, inspiring lay leaders, inspiring the constituency or clients you're working with, and is deeply meaningful that to be in that position and to know that you're affecting so many lives and making the world better.
That's great. Yeah. A friend of my husband used the quote, and I'm sure you've heard it, but in context of a rabbi, but for any one of us, you're no kind of rabbi if they don't try to run you out of town, and you're no kind of man if they succeed. And man, woman, other.
Sorry. I like the first half of that quote.
Good. Not the second. Good. But it's, I mean, it is, you know, you said the sort of EQ, like there's an element of where you're just not going to please everyone. And that's, you know, CEO positions, and that's other, you know, types of executive decision-making positions. And there's going to be conflict, and there's going to be times that really suck. And then you get through it, and then people forget that you did that thing, or that decision was made, or they didn't like a way something happened. And then you can continue the work and move forward. But, you know, I kind of always have this, weird dichotomy of thinking that everyone in these positions have these like rose colored glasses, and they just like are so good at all the things, and nobody ever like hates them, and they just are so great at schmoozing everybody. And I'm just, you know, flawed, but obviously that's not the case. And we are all human. Oh, and
don't be so hard on yourself.
But it's important. It's important to understand. It's important to work on.
But I will say, like, everyone has flaws. No one's given a full deck of cards, even the best of us. And one of the skills of being a CEO is to recognize that in yourself, and then to hire the people who can make up the rest of it. And that's the most important thing a CEO can do, is to hire the best people. I think we went back to before, but it's really about people who complement you.
Well, hire the best people and develop the best people. Right. If you've got somebody within your ranks that's really great, that serves that, push them up, right? Get them the skills, give them the kavod, give them the title change, and get them into, you know, more of a support role.
That's right. What was it called? You hire fast, promote faster, and fire fastest.
Mm, I love it. Not in synagogues, my friend.
Well, maybe
might be true in other nonprofits.
I think synagogues can learn from that. I certainly think nonprofit organizations, you hire the best people as fast as you can. When they're really excellent, you promote them even faster. But then you really have to get rid of people who are not aligned with the mission, who are wasting time and energy, or are toxic as quickly as possible.
Amen. Amen. So we covered a lot of ground, your own personal story, the work of the Federation, the vision, big stuff, the little stuff. Anything that we've left on the table that you want to comment on as we wrap up our conversation?
Yeah, I'm going to leave you with a word of Torah, because it's almost Shabbat. Awesome. And I'm a rabbi. So this is Parshat Chukai, which is like so famous for the Miriam story.
Mm.
And Miriam has a very particular kind of leadership style that doesn't get lauded enough. She's not out in front. She's not Moses. She's not Aaron. She's not the one who's out there giving big pronouncements or big speeches. She's not the one who's facilitating the elite and doing, rituals or what have you. She's the prophetess in the background, but she was responsible for the most vital part of the community, which was she actually brought the water.
Mm.
And when she passed away, the water dried up. And I just don't want to forget that kind of leader is just as important as the loud one, and that taken for granted often. And just as Miriam was able to shape the environment in which the other leaders could lead.
Mm.
I think any leader who's listening to this or watching or is ready for Shabbat, just like I am, you need that space to water yourself. You need that space to be yourself. And as leaders, you need to really pay attention to the people who are quietly doing the righteous work in the background.
Well, I love that. That has definitely filled me up for as the person in the background, mostly for my Shabbat practice. So I appreciate that, Rabbi Farkas. Thank you so much. This has been so wonderful to hear from you. Congratulations again on your appointment. And I'm so excited to see where you take this organization for probably the rest of your career, hopefully, that they can hold on to you. But it really is a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. So great to be with you.
Liked this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.